Hey everyone, it's Norm, and I want to welcome you all to the very first Owl Talk. Before we get into the introduction, I just want to say that this recording is a little rough around the edges, but the content is so good that I think it's still very much worth the effort to get this out. We have plans to continue to do this in the future, and with your feedback and support, these are only going to get better. This whole talk was recorded in two parts, the meat and potatoes of the talk, and then the Q&A. After my introduction, you'll hear a brief pause, and then I'll go right into ACR, and then Wolf will begin his talk. Before we go into questions, there will be another pause and another edit into ACR's entry of the Q&A portion. Again, apologies for the rough production, but I'm super hopeful that this is only going to get better. So without further ado, we are honored to have Wolf speak for the first Owl Talk hosted by the Project Owl OSIN community. Currently, Wolf is a section chief at a public safety agency with 14 years of public safety experience across a variety of different agencies, and he is currently working towards a graduate degree in violence studies and counterterrorism. The topics he will address will be basic violence risk assessment, the basics of behavioral threat analysis, examining potential risks of violence, and much, much more. With that, let's get this started. A big shout out to the Project Owl community. Without you, we really wouldn't be doing this. ACR and Wolf for graciously giving us their time, and as well as people who asked the questions. All right, I hope you guys enjoy the talk.
This is Wolf. He's one of our OSINT fellows, a longstanding member of the community, and probably one of my personal favorite people here, but I don't pick favorites. So just a heads up before we start, this is going to be a talk about violence. If you have any triggers that happen with violence in a whole, please be aware that you may encounter something. If anything gets to you in a way that you feel uncomfortable, please take the moment to just step away from the computer, take five, and come back. And if you can't bear through it, we have no problem with you dipping out. I just wanted to make sure that that's aware on the front end. So I have gone ahead and done my introduction. I'll turn it over to Wolf, and he's going to run the show. I will ask that if you have a question, please post it in the discussion and questions chat. And then when we move to the Q&A section, just raise your hand.
All right. Thank you. I really appreciate everybody being here. It's kind of exciting for the first time going through and presenting these talks, and I am very honored to be first one really talking about this. And I think it's fitting that the first Owl Talk we are doing is on this concept of violence. It may seem to be a little bit of an odd topic for OSINT, but it's a really, what I think, critical topic and one that perhaps is not understood as well as it really should be to help further the work that we're doing. So violence, this is a core theme in humanity across history, shapes nations, defines generations, forms legacies. In the open source intelligence community, much of what we track, analyze, or discuss is essentially centered on violence. Whether it's tracking political violence in Africa, discussing religious violence in the Middle East, following violent attacks in the Americas, or geolocating military assets in the Caucasus Mountains, the events of violence permeate every layer of the work that we do. And I find that it is easy to become detached from behind the screen, studying the mechanics and technical aspects of what unfolds for us. But we really need to be reminded that there is a human component to all of this. Emotions, thoughts, and behaviors are part and parcel of that plane track, or that Twitter thread, or that lone wolf attack. Therefore, we need to not just understand the tools and events of, but the pathway towards that violence itself. So I've had most of my professional and academic careers have been centered around violence. I've held a number of positions in a variety of roles that all have to do with the prevention, treatment, administration of violence. In my undergrad, I studied economics and history, focusing on military history and the history of extremism. And during economics classes, I became interested in behavioral economics, which started to lead me down this question of how do people get on these pathways in their lives? Over the past 14 years, I've spent time as a police student intern, Army medic, DOD security contractor, volunteer firefighter, emergency manager, health and safety specialist, mental health law enforcement officer, and family violence. I treated violence as an Army medic and as a civilian EMS command medic. I experienced violence and numerous injuries that came from it during brutal detainment fights with individuals under the influence of meth and synthetic drugs. I've experienced and witnessed and prevented violence during my time in a very specialized law enforcement unit that focused on mentally ill sex offenders. I counseled victims of sexual violence and saw the toll that such violence takes on humans and cultures. I secured United States Air Force bases from violence as a contractor, and I managed natural violence as disasters as a planning chief for emergency management. I even enjoy violence as a sport during MMA, doing MMA training, and watching and participating in MMA fights. I study violence as an academic subject and the radicalization process of violence extremists, especially in the context and through the lenses and understanding a white supremacy and counter-white supremacy movement. So during all of this, you know, living with this constant specter of violence as one would like a roommate, I've come to realize that even though violence is around us and with us as humans in almost daily attributes, we still struggle to understand it. And we struggle to understand what the actual risk to us is violence and understand why this individual we see on that news or that we are reading about in that paper or we're chasing down a Twitter thread on why they chose the violence. So today, what I really want to talk about, what we're going to look at, is what actually is violence and how violence. I will be posting in the chat. There will be a handout called Understanding Violence. It's slowly pulling it up on my computer, but I'm going to post it, and it's going to contain just a few handouts on some kind of information resolved around violence. And there's actually an outdated one. I don't know, ACR, if you could post that in the chat.
Yeah.
That would be perfect. And I'll post an updated one here after the presentation because it looks like I have to change up something else.
Just making sure before we move on, this is the one you're talking about, right?
Yeah, is that in the...
It's in the discussion and questions
yes.
chat.
Yep, that will be it.
Okay, cool.
So to talk about and understand violence, we'll go through some definitions. So violence is often defined, and this is common. If you Google the word violence, this will come up. Use of physical force so as to injure, abuse, damage, or destroy. There's some other definitions floating around. I happen to like this one as well. The defined as strength of emotion or an unpleased or destructive control. We're going to spend some time kind of talking about the emotional connection that violence occurs. The big definition that a lot of agencies and organizations tend to use comes from the World Health Organization. And the World Health Organization defines this concept of violence as the intentional use of physical force or power, threatened or actual, against oneself, another person, or against a group or community, which either results in or has high likelihood of resulting in injury, death, psychological harm, maldevelopment. The World Health Organization further breaks down violence into three broad categories: self-inflicted, interpersonal. From there is a typology of violence that gets scattered into multiple categories, and I will be posting here in a minute a chart that shows that topic. But for our real intents and purposes, what we're really wanting to look at and what we focus a lot on as a community is that idea of interpersonal violence, especially when we talk about what is referred to as community violence, such as an acquaintance of a community or a stranger to a community that goes forth and perpetuates violence against that community. Or collective violence. And this is really when we get into social violence, political violence, economics violence, you know, exchanges between factions or states of. To begin looking at violence, there's a caveat I want to put to all of this. The word violence and this idea of violence, you know, it begins to bring about a negative connotation. And violence, you know, tends to be viewed as this negative thing. And it's important to keep in mind that violence is a tool that humans use as a form of aggression to advance their ideas. And sometimes you have to use violence as a tool. Sometimes a country has to use violence to stop genocide happening from or to a community. Sometimes an individual has to use violence to stop another individual who may be in the middle of perpetuating a mass community violence, such as we see in mass attacks where security forces have to shoot and stop attackers. So there's elements out there where violence in of itself is used as a tool. And what this can become is a discussion based around the morality and ethics of when and why and where and how it becomes appropriate to use that violence as a tool. So it's even though we are looking at this concept of violence and we're going to talk about, you know, tools and assessing violence, it's important to acknowledge that there is a very large underpinning ethical and morality-based discussion that also needs to happen at the same time. That this is not something that can really just be in a vacuum, but there is a very appropriate amount of consideration that can go into that. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about that. This is not really an ethics class. That's not my academic background. Is you know, going and doing the long ethical doctorate programs and all that kind of stuff. But that is really important work that is being done in the field. There's a lot of really great research that's done into that and discussions about that, you know, networking further with religious and ethnic and indigenous communities and how all of that looks. And so it's important to just acknowledge that before we move on. But when we talk about the violence in this interpersonal and this collective types of settings of violence and what we usually watch and track, you know, whether it's in our North America channel or talking about, you know, rocket attacks or whatever is going on, we have to start with this concept of volatility, because that is really a driving factor to violence being chosen to be used as a tool by an individual or by a collective. So this concept of volatility, what I like to use when I am teaching these kind of classes and I'm teaching people about escalation tactics, I'm teaching them about, you know, how to understand the concepts of threats to individuals, is I use a lot of what comes from an individual called Dr. John Azar Dickens. Dr. Azar Dickens is a forensic psychologist. He currently works in Rome, Georgia, the United States of America. And there not only is he a sworn police officer, but he's also he does forensics works in psychology. Teaches a lot of violence studies, a lot of threat assessment and management courses, and works for a organization called Force Sciences Institute that does a lot of research and studies based around this concept. And one of the things that he developed for his contact or his assessment matrix that's commonly called the Azar Dickens Police Assessment Matrix, which is essentially a risk matrix used for law enforcement officers in the United States to sort of understand people in crisis and behaviors that they have. He breaks this idea of volatility into two different types, primal and cognitive. And I find that this is a really useful kind of entry-level, real basic, quick guide to understand this volatility. And so primal volatility, when we talk about primal volatility, this is strong emotional connection to events that are happening. So that there is a volatile emotional state that is driving thoughts, decisions, action, and then cognitive volatility. And so this is where there is a careful, conscious decision to actually make the choice to do those thoughts, behaviors. You may have heard this sometimes if you're watching the really cheesy cop shows and you hear, oh, crime of passion. A lot of the times what they're referring to is this idea of a volatile emotional drive. Cognitive is where you get more into radicalization and extremists where there's thought planning. It's that lone wolf carrying out a mass attack. It is that group that is carrying out a system of bombings over the course of a that there's a cognitive volatility that has built up and worked to make it. So we'll start first talking about primal. To understand primal volatility, it's a really basic concept that's really great and really can help kind of wrap minds around what this looks like and how to see primal volatility is this idea that comes from, it can be referred to as Beck's triad. You may have heard of it as the cognitive loop. You may have heard of it as the cognitive triangle. But it's the idea that thoughts, emotions, behaviors are looped together. So think of the word thoughts, and then it is in a circle with behaviors or emotions up next, behaviors afterwards, feeding into thoughts. Thoughts, how we feel or what we think, feeds into how we feel, emotions, and emotions feeds into how we behave. How we behave feeds into what we think. This cognitive loop is where you begin to see these primal volatility. As humans, we all have this internal controls, is what we usually kind of call it in the field, these internal controls that are keeping us from acting out on impulse, acting out on whatever you want to call it, baser instinct. And that's usually defined how you grew up, your religion, your morality base, things you were taught as a kid, your socioeconomic status, all these kind of things. They contribute to your internal controls. There's been a lot of studies and a lot of research on it for the scope of this talk. So we won't get too far into it. But if you're interested in this concept of how internal controls develop in somebody, there's a really great study called Adverse Childhood Experiences. I really recommend everybody take a look at it. And it talks about how, you know, what you experience and how you were raised and what your childhood life was like, you know, really begins to sort of develop your worldviews, but also develops how you handle and control emotion. So when we talk about these internal controls are what keeps that sort of cognitive loop in check. So a way to help understand this is, if you are driving, right, and let's say you're one of y'all that live in these big-ass cities where traffic is insane, it takes you 19 hours to go to work, and you have 10,000 cars to fight between you and the next turnoff, and you go to take that exit, and some, you know, jackass in the big souped-up truck with the Confederate flag flying out the back cuts you off, you know, and you miss your exit, and you've got to go another 10 miles down the highway, right? You probably at some point have experienced something like that and have a thought that whatever your favorite word is for a fellow human being that you dislike, I am going to kick his ass. I'm going to run him off the road. I'm going to slam into his car, right? You have some sort of thought like that, but there is an internal control that prevents you from acting out on that thought. So that's what we're talking about when we say internal controls. You know, that whether that be your base morality, you know, your value systems, whatever it is, but there is a control that keeps that leash on that volatility. So when we get into primal volatility, what's happening there is that cognitive loops, the thoughts, emotions, behaviors are feeding into each other. And there's something that they call emotional arousal that is rising up and it begins to break those internal controls. And that's where you then become volatile. That those controls may have been weakened, could be by substance abuse, it could be by alcohol, right? It could be by your relationships and how you handle relationships, it could be by a personality disorder, it could be by a severe mental illness that inhibits your abilities, controls, and makes you more emotionally reactive. There's a whole variety of reasons, but that's where that primal comes through. You were not planning to do that act. You did not wake up that day, decide, I'm going to do X. But events happened, stressors happened, factors happened. There's an increased risk factors. There is a snap, and primal volatility occurs. The thoughts, emotions, behaviors leads into this loop to where eventually there becomes a reaction. I'm going to use violence as an. You can see these sometimes in attacks where you have people that get extremely passionate, enraged, and suddenly, you know, there's fights or there's a stabbing. You know, some sort of event kind of happens where this violence happens. There's a concept in threat management that is called the howlers. And so this idea in the howlers is these are people who are very emotional, very loud. They make a lot of noise. They're easy to see. And they're really, it's like trying to intimidate, it's trying to drive. They're seeking kind of this confrontation and engagement because of the strong emotional pull that they have. And that, a lot of the times, is where, you know, you will see these more, what almost seems to be kind of random events or, you know, short burst you know, fights, or a person that, you know, drives that car into a group of people, or these things that we see, you know, when we see those tweets come out, where it just kind of seems that there was suddenly this event happened with this lone person. And that's really that primal volatility that you're seeing. And a lot of the times this comes from substance abuse as well. You know, when somebody gets on some sort of upper or stimulant that really breaks down those controls. Now, the other side of that is what we talk about is cognitive. And so cognitive really gets into that those internal controls are broken by willful thought processes. So this is really where you get into radicalization and extremist views that start to break down those internal controls, where one of the answers that is now acceptable for me to use to handle this confrontation is violence. And so that's where you really begin to see this pathway towards violence occurring, is that I have been convinced, and now I'm planning to and will act out on a way to carry forward and commit violence. Threat management, these individuals, they tend to call the hunters, and that is predatory people who are quiet, don't make a lot of noise. There's been something going on in their background, and then there is an attack. For those of you that follow all of the mass attacks that we have in North America, how many times do you see that interview is posted up? Oh, the neighbor said he was a quiet guy. Oh, the worker said, yeah, he was kind of odd, but he was quiet and was kind of nice. Is that they are somebody who kind of lies below the surface attention, that there is this cognitive act to be planning and carrying out violence. This is not something where the emotional arousal has risen to such a point where in the moment there is volatility, but that volatility is rising because of willful decisions they have made. To understand the cognitive aspect and how we get there, the radicalization is an entire area to study, and is really important in nowadays, because we're really seeing, you know, further and further rise of extremism. It really caused a lot of people to begin to realize how much we struggle in understanding radicalization with, you know, the rise of what we saw in Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and then 9/11 happened in the U.S., and there was this kind of realization that we don't really spend a lot of time and resources on understanding extremism and radicalization, and that this kind of missed this process of people being radicalized. And even now and today, that there's a lot of concern in Europe, U.S., Canada, where they talk about the rise of right-wing extremism and the radicalization process, because radicalization is getting easier and easier with globalization and the further connection of internet, because what's happening is you have disparate niche communities that are having wider and wider networks, easier and easier access. Because radicalization, one of the best ways to understand radicalization and why these networks matter and why these small niche communities being able to find more members, why all of that creates radicalization, the best way to understand it is from significant quest theory. And so significant quest theory is something that came out a couple years ago, and I find it's really a great way to understand the radicalization process. So in significant quest theory, it talks about needs, narratives, and networks. Those are kind of the three pillars that radicalization occurs under the significant quest theory. And so needs, when they talk about needs, that's that there is a loss of significance in somebody, self-identity, self-worth, their personification. So that there's a sense of victimization here, that they have lost significance, that lost the meaning of life, that kind of identity. And what they need is they need to regain that sense of significance, regain that sense of self-worth. Because that loss as a human being is insurmountable. There's a quote that I make everyone in my agency read and memorize, and the quote's from Police Commissioner Ramsey out of Philadelphia. He used to be there. And it's called The Perfect 10. I'm not going to try to tell you the whole quote, but basically to paraphrase it, it says that, you know, when you're born, you gain a 10, right? Then let's say you're born to a poor, struggling family. You lose 3. Let's say you are born to a community of persecution, right? Or a community that discriminated against, you know, an indigenous community that's being discriminated against, you know, an economically challenged community. But maybe you're part of a community or ethnic minority that experiences a lot of discrimination and persecution, right? You lose another 3 there. You lose maybe another 3 because you get into the workplace or jobs and you struggle to find actual connection. You struggle to find, you know, a job that has meaning. You're struggling to find that financial aspect. So you lose another 3. Well, you've only got now 1 left. And if somebody, that 1 represents their self-respect, their self-worth, and if you take away that 1, they're going to fight like hell to keep it. And I think that quote's really a excellent summary of what we're talking about when we talk about the needs pillar and the significant quest theory, because it is understanding that if somebody loses this loss of significance as a human being, you cannot continue down the road if you do not feel that self-worth, you do not have that significance. So there becomes a need to get it. Second pillar is narrative. And so under this, what they talk about is that you find a narrative that supports your victimization and becomes a narrative that shows you the only pathway you have to retain that significance, gain that significance back, fight against the victimization that you've gone through is this violent extremist cause, that this is a righteous cause. It is a supportive cause. This is the right cause. And then you get into networks, which is the third pillar. And networks is people or a community that has those same goals, that feels that victimization, that feels that limited. And so then it becomes about, I am right in my way of thinking. I become validated in the way of my thinking. This is right. We are the underdogs. We are the persecuted. We have to fight to submit. And that is where radicalization really comes from. And if you pay attention to a lot of religious violence, political violence, extremist violence, most of the time, those violent movements, those violent individuals, you will find this significant quest theory somewhere in. You will find that there was some sort of event or life that caused this loss of significance, that they stumbled upon this narrative that signified that this was the righteous way, that, you know, violence was a tool they needed to use for the aggression, and that they found a network of people to further the results. So it really helps understand when we see events like in Africa, when we see, you know, militias marching into towns and performing these violent acts, or we see, you know, the ongoing battles between ethnic factions, of kind of understanding these really basic principles. And I'm not purporting to be giving, you know, a solid understanding of all of these elements. And there's, you know, thousands of factors that we will never truly understand unless you live that life and you can be in and amongst that communities, but it's helpful to just have a really ground floor understanding of the factors at play here. And so in radicalization, when we look at, you know, is somebody being radicalized, that's what we're looking for. We're looking to try to see, where did that loss of significance come from? Where did they lose that perfect 10, right? How do they gain onto that narrative? A great way, if you are in or have been following what's been happening in the United States, a great thing that is now kind of, everybody's aware of it now, where you can see this happen, is in the Q movement, QAnon movement. Q movement is an excellent example of significant quest theory, because you had people that identified that they were losing their significance, that traditionally these are white, straight, heterosexual males that feel that they're being replaced, that feel that they are losing their significance as the dominant force, and that they are struggling to connect because the world is looking different around them. They're kind of placement as being on a dominating force is being withdrawn. They're feeling that these other individuals are taking on their significance. And so there's a perceived loss of significance. Remember, the loss of significance does not have to be legitimate or not. All that matters is, does that person perceive a loss of significance? And so what we saw is a lot of them saw this loss of significance, and then the Q movement started, and that provided a narrative. A narrative that this was a conspiracy, that they weren't racially biased, that they weren't controlling the world, all these other elements, that Q was providing them a narrative that showed that, yes, they were the victims of this bigger agenda, that they were being attacked. And so then you had the networks that arouse out of those Q movements. And that's why you could see, even there's such a passionate, desperate attempt to hold on to that ideology, to hold on to that movement, because that movement was their self. And is why, even to this day, you still have members of the Q movement talking about how Q was right, and here's the next predictions. Because to say this movement was wrong or we made a mistake was to question the very essence of their self-worth. And that's important to understand with radicalization, because trying to de-radicalize somebody, if you get into the world of counter-radicalization, it is extremely difficult, because you essentially have to then look at and break down that person's self-identity. It's actually very similar to when I used to manage, track, hunt, and detain sex offenders, because a lot of the individuals we dealt with, and I specialized in child sex offenders, it was impossible to go in and make them better. In the sense of, oh, I see the errors of my ways, I will no longer do this. But tons and tons of research, I'm just very quickly summarizing a lot of really important concepts out there. I encourage you to research it further if you have interests. But with the sex offenders that we used to deal with and spend a lot of time interviewing and talking with, they could not be that it was tied into their self-worth, tied into their identity, and the very fabric of who are. The few that were able to be successful had to completely break down the very core element of who they were to get out of that. So most of them did not have that internal controls like we talked about. So we had to build external controls, where your U.S. Marshals and task forces and all other elements come into play on monitoring, tracking, and then the moment they stepped out of line, you had to go in and get them, because the internal controls did not exist. They had such a kind of a radicalized thought process that you could not train that out. You could not, build that out or build their own internal controls. And so you had to put external controls in. A lot of the times you can see this in radicalization process too. It's very difficult to get somebody out of a radicalized movement because it's so tied in itself. So with all that being said, how do you address any of this? So the way we address a lot of this is through what I specialize in, what my career has become, threat assessment and management as a counter-violence tactic, as a way to prevent these things from happening. So essentially with threat assessment and management, using OSINT, we actually do a lot of OSINT in my line of work, and protective intelligence, but more focused on OSINT centered around people, individuals, community topics, chatter on social media, that kind of stuff. Because what we're looking for is we are looking for the actual concepts of these risk factors that are starting to form. So in the handout that was posted, you will see that I have listed in there the violence risk assessment factors on page two. And I'll get an update. Has some other stuff for people. So what we're looking for in threat assessment and management, what we're looking for in what's called protective intelligence, which is essentially using OSINT and some other things out there to look at protecting individuals, communities, from violence, you're looking for these risk factors. Because we're trying to find before they become radicalized or before they get to that cognitive loop that causes them to become primal. Volatility that there's an intervention that can occur, that we can grab that individual and do other things with that individual before they get past that primal volatility standpoint, begin using violence as an aggression, or before they get to that cognitive radicalized process to where they are now planning to carry an attack and you now have actual like terroristic events and actions that are being planned. Where intervention now legal action. So this is a great little risk assessment matrix. This is not, I'm just throwing up kind of a real brief example of a risk assessment matrix if you have never seen one before. This is a violence risk assessment factors on the one side. This comes from a lot of different books and literatures out there. I'm talking about escalating risk factors. But what I want to point out is that if you're looking at these escalating risk factors, notice that a lot of them have to do with trying to identify what are the patterns, what are the risks that may be emerging with this individual where those controls are being degraded, where there is a starting to be a risk of primal volatility. So active substance abuse, particularly with alcohol, research shows that alcohol abuse really tends to drive this lowered inhibition towards violence. And so usually with alcohol patterns, that's a big risk factor for propensity of violence. Impulse control disorders are naturally already a risk factor in there, especially if they're untreated. Most of the time, if they're treated and they're taking medications, medication compliance, it's not really an issue. But what you're really looking for is that there's untreated impulse control issues there. That have not been diagnosed, have not been untreated, that could lower that inhibitions and increase the propensity of violence as well. Social media, obviously, this was one thing that's really important to look at. Really looking at the wording, how they are choosing to word things, which groups are they in with? Are they starting to use words that are showing that there is a perceived loss of significance? That's really things we hone in on when we start seeing people who post about. This idea of perceived loss of significance, or starting to post about being victimized, or post about identifying themselves with other groups out there that have been victimized, that especially are linked towards violence. That's what we really want to pay attention to. Violence towards authority, because that usually shows that there's starting to be a breakdown of the internal controls. When you see people who stage attacks, that's a really key factor, right? And when you look at, for example, riots, and you're kind of like looking at, okay, I need to judge, what's this person risk level? They participate in a riot, what do they do in the riot? If they were, for example, attacking medics like EMS providers during a riot, that's usually a very high risk factor because that's not somebody that is normally identified with, the people they're fighting. This is kind of more of an example of a higher risk of violence because it is primal volatility at this point, lashing out and attacking targets that are not necessarily identified with the movement or the cause of trying to work. Incarceration due to assault, I mean, that's always an easy one. A lot of times you can learn in court view, say, hey, this person's got a bunch of assault history, kind of shows you patterns of behavior. Stalking kidnapping behavior is always a huge red flag. Stalking somebody is almost always a sign that there is some serious cognitive volatility there, that this individual is somebody who is planning or who has previously undetectedly conducted violence on people. Stalking is usually considered an extremely high-risk behavior. There's entire units out there that are devoted to stalking. A lot of it also tends to be sexual violence of nature, especially guys stalking women is seen a lot, and that's usually something that always kind of triggers some major red flags that that person needs to be carefully monitored. Kidnapping behavior as well. Kidnapping is usually an extremely high behavior. And then on the next slide, this is an example to just, and this is, again, this is coming from a very generic kind of ideology of it, and you can get into really complex, and I have an example on some other complex in the handout, other complex violence risk assessments. But I like this even just as, I'll actually throw this up when there's like a big event in, you know, a mass attack, or we're reading about, you know, militia members carrying out some sort of an assault, or you know, some sort of mass attack happened in Europe, is they're talking about, okay, here's a suspect. And if you pull this up, you can kind of begin to see red flags looking at that suspect's past history. And you can see that what this is really all talking about in these different risk categories is, does this person have patterns, behaviors, or indications that there is lowered internal controls, that they are primarily volatile, or that they are carrying out cognitive plans and planning for. So that's really what's driving on. They can see, you know, in high risk, current high lethal plan, you know, that's cognitive, available means, right? Is there a history of homicide attempts or impulsive acting out? Do they have a history of that more primal volatility, right? Feels a strong urge to control and get even with a significant other. Domestic violence is always a major indicator that somebody lacks some internal controls, and it tends to be more primal volatile. Substance abuse, again, is always a concern. And then, you know, high lethal suicide risk. If they have a lot of suicide attempts, they talk about suicide by cop, or they're going to go in and do a mass attack, you know, lethal suicide shooting. Those can be what's considered high lethal suicide risk, where somebody wants to go out and bring a lot of other people with them. So it's something to just kind of help keep in mind that really what we're doing is when we're looking at why did this person carry out violence, you're looking at what is the history of this individual, what are those patterns, what are the thoughts, emotions, behaviors that they have that can be seen in kind of an OSINT context. To have an example of what this threat assessment process looks like, you know, threat assessment is a formal investigatory process that, you know, agencies, mostly in the Americas and in Europe, I haven't seen a whole lot of this spread to Africa or Southeast Asia areas, and I'm not sure what Central Asia, if they've really done anything with this, but it's mostly in kind of Europe and the Americas right now. But it's this idea that you try to identify people prior to it. You begin doing inquiries on them. You assess their actual propensity of violence and the risk that they've posed. And then you put together a management plan, kind of like a case management plan prior to needing arrests or actions. The HCR 120 on, right there on the side just kind of gives you an idea of what a real formal, this is the short version, but a real formal violence risk assessment. So, just to kind of summarize and wrap up some ideas on what we've got here, this concept of violence, this concept of, you know, how somebody chooses to commit that violence, how somebody becomes radicalized, what does extremism actually look like, really looking for what's the volatility of this person. Does this person move more towards that there is a primal volatility, that there is a struggling to control emotions that break down those barriers that causes these emotional output that then chooses violence as an aggression? Or is this somebody that is cognitively moving down this pathway through radicalization? And really that significant quest theory, showing that loss of significance, the need to find significance to retain self-worth, finding narratives that supports that need, and finding the network that supports that narrative so you can kind of go together and further the goals of the group. That radicalization process is a lot of the times what you see when there's this cognitive volatility coming forward. And then as a kind of a way to counter all of this, the threat assessment and management, I'm really trying to identify those individuals who are beginning to go down that road, try to intervene beforehand, try to build up case management plans with them, you know, seek mental assistance when they need mental health assistance. You know, if there's socioeconomic factors that need to get put into play there, try to get them hooked up with more programs. A lot of times in counter extremism, it's talked about rerouting people who have that sort of the needs and narrative, to rerouting them to peaceful activism, to groups that they can connect with, networks that they can connect with that do not use violence to further their goal, that where they can still feel significance, they can still begin to address some of those issues, the perceived loss, the victimization through non-violent means and perform the intervention. Counter-extremism project's got a lot of really good stuff about that if you're interested in counter-extremism. And so if we kind of understand all of those things and just understand what violence is and understand what you're looking at, you know, when you're doing this work, I think it helps bring a little bit more context to the actual open source intelligence work that's being done, that you understand, you know, why exactly we're geolocating those riots in Myanmar and why are they happening? You know, why have people been shot and killed? That understanding that, I think, brings a little bit more relevance to the fantastic work that all of you have been doing, you know, in this server. And I just encourage you to just kind of be thinking that there, ultimately at the end of the day, there's a human component to all of this. We're not OSINTing robots yet, well, except Amy on her drones, but we're not OSINTing Skynet, that everything we are doing and involving with is got a human component. So we need to understand that human drive. We need to understand why a human would choose to commit that violence and cause that event we're all now monitoring. So with that, I really appreciate everybody's time. That's kind of the information that I've got to share. I'll try to work on getting that updated handout here in a second into the group. But let's open it up for questions, ACR.
All right. First and foremost, Wolf, wow. You have just absolutely crushed the bar on how these should go in the future. I think I can speak for everybody here that that was probably the most information-packed, just amazing talk I've heard, and probably since I was in college.
So I have the advantage of doing these kinds of teachings pretty often, so I can't really claim too much credit.
Aw. Don't shy yourself short, or don't sell yourself short. All right, so folks, we're going to move into the Q&A session now. I'm going to take a break for about 2 minutes to go get some water. Anybody else is more than encouraged to. If anybody has any questions that they're willing to ask by voice or through speaking, go ahead and use the raise your hand function, and then when I get back, I'll start going one by one and pulling people in so you can ask your question, and then I'll probably send you right back down to the audience after this. I've got a set of questions already prepared, but I want to make sure everybody has a couple minutes to get up, walk around. If you've been sitting for the whole 50 minutes of Wolf's been talking here, you know, get your blood flowing a little bit. So we'll reconvene in about 2 to 5 minutes, and we'll go from there. Perfect. If you have any questions you don't want to ask with your own voice, you can definitely put them in the discussion and question section, and we'll go from there. Please feel free to use the raise hand function. I can pull you in so you can ask your question and then throw you back into the audience. You don't have to ask a question. We would love to hear from everybody. I have a list of already predetermined questions. And after that, I could probably bullshit my own questions. We'll go from there. All right, Ghost Boy, if you're ready, I'm going to pull you up. And then if you could just do me a favor, state your name or your username and your question, and then I will move you back.
My name is Jordan. Question is pretty simple. It's for you, Wolf. In your opinion, in the, let's say, past 5 years or so, have you seen a the level of which people, actually, let me rephrase that, how people commit these extremist crimes get worse, such as like what they are doing when they commit these acts of extremism or hate against other groups of people? Has it gotten more heinous?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, that's that's something that is really looked at, kind of thoughtful in what we do, especially when you get into more counter extremism. Okay, what are the trends? What are we seeing? There's a couple of things that I'll try to kind of hit on a couple of the smaller points that I think you're really driving at. Is it getting more heinous? It's a good question, and it's one that I think there is a heavy bias towards, because really looking at history, history has got some terrible, heinous events that go in there that are just horrific use. All the way from persecutions that was conducted in the Rome era, the persecutions that was conducted against Native Americans coming over. It was really, terrible things that were done. Some pretty creative torture methods that I don't think we've quite have seen replicated. So I think the extreme violence, has that increased? I think there could be an argument made that not really. At the end of the core day, human beings are going to be crappy when they're doing this kind of stuff. So with that, I think, though, does it seem to be getting worse? And I think there absolutely could be an argument that, yes, it absolutely is. And a lot of that has to do with the globalization of our media content creation. If a guy right now goes off and chops the head off of another person somewhere in a country somewhere, and anybody's got a smartphone of any type, there's a good chance that's going to get recorded, posted on social media, and it goes viral. And so I think the level of awareness is going up, and I think the exposure is going up. And it's something that's really interesting. If you look at ISIS or, Islamic State or whatever you want to call them, but they had a very high emphasis on media production and the skills to produce media that show these just terrible things happening in such a crystal clear, high definition, well-produced video, because there was this understanding, right, of how are we going to attract followers and get the message out there and be able to show, what we're doing, right? Because it just like I was talking about that significant quest theory, the networks, right? If you want to radicalize somebody, you've got to build that narrative and you have to build that network. And so if you have a really well-produced video, it shows, this isn't just some random guy in a cave with a shitty Sony camcorder. It's that there is a movement, an organization, knowledge, skills behind this thing, how maybe this is the right thought. We see that too with a lot of the combat footage that was coming out in Syria, where there was some really pretty high fidelity recorded combat that we had not really seen before. GoPros on tanks and 4K cameras running, and a lot of that was kind of ramping up the sort of rhetoric or the not necessarily rhetoric but the sort of awareness of these events that were going on. So I think that the base level, at the end of the day, nothing we're really seeing is new in the core concepts of humanity, but the reach of it, the speed of it, the ability for us to process and gain information on it is unparalleled, unmatched, and is at an exponential rate increasing. And so what that does is that increases the risk of radicalization, increases the risk of extremism, increases the risk of, something like Q developing, because now all these people can network. And so that's where it begins to get worse, more extreme, more.
All right. Well, thank you, Jordan, Ghost Boy, for the question. Like I said, if anybody else has any other questions that they'd like to ask over the mic, please don't be shy. I promise none of us here bite. If not, I will ask your question for you. Just make sure you post it in the discussion questions. Until then, Mr. Wolf, I have about 12 questions from our resident buddy PBR, who has a wonderful, wonderful mind. and has put together a very thoughtful list, and I've condensed some of it down. So his first question is how did you get into the field that you currently are in now? And I'm going to kind of add a couple more onto that. With what would be the most memorable story you have from your career so far, if you're able to do so without absolutely doxing yourself?
Yeah. So, you know, the way I kind of fell into doing this, it was not really on purpose, honestly. Mostly it was coming from, you know, doing medicine as a civilian, doing medicine in the Army, you know, getting more and more involved in that, kind of got handed the reins to a civilian EMS agency where we did a lot of drug use, sort of detainment, assisted law enforcement in that. And we dealt a lot with psychiatric patients. And so it kind of began to raise this interest, which I've kind of always had in college, of behaviors and behavioral economics. Of, you know, why is this happening, this experience with dealing with mental health patients and just a lot of the extremely high levels of violence I was exposed to, you know, doing those jobs, which then led me down this path of going into law enforcement, being involved in a drugs and alcohol unit for a minute, and then being recruited into a very specialized mental health unit. And then I specialize in that mental health unit in the child sex crimes and begin to deal with individuals who had psychosis and severe mental illness. And it really kind of began to study this understanding risk, because when you deal with sex offenders, you are essentially a risk manager. You're constantly looking at the risk that this person poses to the community. You know, what's the levels of risk, right? What is the moment that they start recidivizing towards a possible sexual crime? What stages are they in? You know, have they committed a sexual crime? Do we need to detain them now? Are they post-conviction status and they're out? We need to monitor them. So there's kind of like all these elements to really understanding and assessing this sort of risk levels. The threat, and that's essentially what we're doing, is looking at threat. That really kind of began to get me interested on, hey, is there a way to do this just beyond sex offenders? Because this works. This works in the sense of we're devoting a lot of resources to keeping an eye on people who potentially do damage or have done damage or in the middle of doing damage and able to assess what's the actuality of that and do we need to intervene? That's kind of what I then stumbled into. Threat assessment and management on building this out, you know, as a unit, as a program, and getting more involved in that throughout the Pacific Northwest on looking at threat assessment and management. So it was kind of this interesting pathway from, you know, where I started, you know, economics and history and got into the military and got into medicine, began to do some contracting work, kind of did physical security planning. You know, that was kind of interesting, but sort of boring. Stayed in this medicine for a while and then drifted through law enforcement, and while always just kind of keep on this tack towards mental health and risk, and then beginning to apply all of those principles from basically everything I've done into threat assessment and management. Whether, you know, from assessing security of a building, you're still looking at vulnerability assessments, to assessing a individual, you're looking at the vulnerabilities that individual has. What are the hooks that somebody can limp into that person to radicalize, bring them into extremism? And so just kind of bringing a lot of those concepts from these other fields into threat assessment and management, which is already a very multidisciplinary field, it kind of really helped propel the career at a pretty quick pace to what I'm doing now. For stories, though, story I always like to trot out, the best war story I've got of an example of what primal volatility looks like with substances. It was during the spice epidemic, and we were dealing with kind of a, not quite a riot, I don't know what you would call it. But anyways, we were dealing with these groups of people in an undisclosed location in the old Pacific Northwest. And I had a riot shield on, came across this old, or a riot helmet with a visor. I came across this sweet old Asian lady that was like probably 80 years old. And she was fighting with these people. So kind of walking up to her, and she reaches behind her, like concentrates for a second. I realize she just shat into her hand, pulls the shit out from behind her, puts puts it in her mouth, chews it for a moment, and then spat it all along my riot helmet visor. And I just remember looking at this ancient woman who was whacked out of her mind on fucking spice, we found out, who had just spit literal shit onto my face visor. And I just remember being so glad that I lowered that visor before I approached that woman. It's probably the best story.
Wow. I think that that's probably the best response I could think of is just, wow. I have, in all my years, never heard of a story like that. That's insane.
It's fun times, you know. Spice is a hell of a drug. Don't do spice, kids. It's what I always like to say, because otherwise you're going to be eating poop.
All right. Moving on to the next question that I've got. This one's going to kind of be a block of questions, because it seems like everybody's interested in the career aspect of it. So we'll circle back on that. I wanted to pick this out because this one stood out the most to me. So using any of the open source intelligence that you use in your day-to-day job, do you think the, quote, bad guys are also using the same methods if they are doing it criminally to get away with whatever they're doing and avoid having you come in and proverbially kick the door down and take them off to jail?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's without a doubt. I mean, it's one of the things why, you know, this is not, when we talk about protective intelligence, when we talk about, oh, I'm going to go, you know, follow extremist telegrams, that's not something I really would ever recommend to anybody sitting in the server as something to just get into without really understanding what you're doing, because there is absolutely, essentially counterintelligence measures being employed by some of these individuals, especially some of the more organized radicals, that there is always a sort of ongoing attempt to look at who's got proxy accounts. You know, can I find members of the community that we're targeting, you know, whether it be profession, ethnicity, whatever, but can I find their information online? Can I build a target profile against them? You know, having just completely open social media profiles that are not locked down, that has your real name, that has geolocational information in it, all of those things, it puts you absolutely at a target. And there are elements that do that. I mean, one of the common things that I do in my work is protect agency members who are being targeted by organized groups. And we are run into that, sadly, fairly often, where there are attempts to identify family members, friends, you know, places that they visit, based off of OSINT, based off of social media, based off satellite imaging and geotags, photos, all of that kind of stuff. It is absolutely happening. And it's one of the things that, you know, just as much as we may be taking a look at satellite imaging, we may be taking a look at that open Facebook profile, just understand that the same is being done to us. And so having a really good locked down approach is kind of crucial, you know, which is one of the things why, you know, we have people on the server that do cybersecurity, and I'm not even close to a cybersecurity expert at all. I'm lucky if I can plug a USB in port okay. Cybersecurity is definitely a rapidly growing field, and it's beyond just the element of, you know, locking down servers and protecting from threats, but also this kind of idea of, well, what's that personal identifiable information out there? You know, how secure do you have your ability to be OSINTed against?
I think that's a great answer. It always amazes me when I hear stories of individuals going out and using even non-OSINT techniques to track other parties. And TV did a great job of every time the CSI guy is typing in the computer and hacking into the mainframe, there's always the hacker on the other end hacking back at him. So it's a great way to think that if you're able to do it to somebody else, they're more than likely able to do it to you. And if you're not careful, you know, yeah, it could bite you in the ass.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's something where if you're going to pull up that Telegram channels and you're going to, you know, dive into all of that stuff, you know, that you just, you shouldn't be doing that in a vacuum. You know, you should really be kind of reaching out and looking at, hey, what's the best way to do this? How should I be doing this? You know, this isn't the same necessarily as like, I'm going to jump on, you know, FR24 or ADSB or something.
Yeah. 100%.
There's a direct counter to what you're doing.
Of course. And I do want a real quick plug that, should anybody get the idea that joining any Telegram using their own cell phone number, bad idea. Don't do it. We do not want to get into the habit of having users getting openly doxxed by extremist groups that use Telegram. So please don't take that very seriously. Your personal information matters.
Absolutely.
So there was one question by Midwest who states that if federal legislation were to be put in place to help combat radicalism and extremism and bolster the ability for states themselves to do it, what are some critical points that you think should be or should include for both subject matters?
Oh, that's a great question, and what I would expect from Midwest. You know, that it's an interesting question, because I think this is actually something that there is a lot of eyes at this. And of course, we're looking at this through the lens of the United States. You know, we're talking about this from the federal perspective of the United States. But there's a lot of questions right now in the U.S. on that very topic, because of the January 6th insurrection that occurred and sort of that extremist movement that allowed it to build and the failure that intelligence had, because even, you know, Capitol Police is a very large threat assessment and management section. And there was a pretty significant failure to really develop the appropriate threat profiles. And so, you know, how did that happen? And so I think legislations, I would keep an eye for, I think most likely what's going to happen is you're going to see a lot of increased funding to Department of Homeland Security. We don't really do threat assessment a whole lot at the federal level. The United States Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center is probably the premier agency that does this, and NTAC has put out a lot of really great publications. I really encourage you. They've been really focusing on school safety and school mass attacks, because it's kind of been really in everybody's you know, mind's eye in the U.S. But I think that you're going to see kind of more discussions on targeted violence, which is a newer word that's being used a lot, and it's really this cognitive volatility, you know, this violent actions that are being specifically targeted because of political ideology or religious ideology. And that is something that I think we're going to see, like the Office of Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention, we're going to see that getting expanded. I would love to see legislation come out that really targets funding that at a state level. You know, states all have fusion centers, which are like criminal intelligence centers, basically work to kind of combine all sources of intelligence at a criminal law enforcement intelligence level. And I think something like that needing to get funded for each 50 states to really allow a center for counter-extremism, counter-violence, you know, targeted violence work and prevention, the sort of state-level threat assessment and management that's being funded directly by the feds would go a long ways to begin to address this. Because it's really going to be building communities and stakeholders, you know, especially when you deal with threat assessment and management, you have to build bridges and liaisons with them. You know, you need those people on your threat assessment teams that are coming from the communities that are your community leaders. You need your pastors, you need your imams, you know, you need your rabbis are sitting on those teams. You need your mental health clinicians, you need your, you know, your school psychiatrists, you need all these people that really are involved in it, because the goal is not to just have the door kicked in and the, you know, get dragged off by the goon squad. You don't want that, because by then, you know, it's way too late. You really want to jump in kind of prior to even getting to that point. And the only way to do that is really build bridges in the community. And the only way to do that is you got to have this sort of ideas and programs and subject matter experts at a local, regional, state level for that to really occur. And I think that's only going to really happen if there is sort of a national push to fund this, to make this a priority, and to really address the kind of the epidemic of violence with real counter violence programs and counter extremism programs.
Wow, that's a wonderful response. I appreciate it. That's a great question. I think one of my favorite things about a federal legislation coming down is definitely the funding aspect. I think that most departments are definitely underfunded when it comes to a violent and threat assessment level. And I feel like that would help with an earlier intervention on violent offenders, thus leading to, you know, more rehabilitation instead of incarceration, which I'm always a huge fan of.
Yeah. Well, and it's really, you know, it's sort of, this is kind of sort of a symptom of one of the big problems that, you know, America has, where we don't want to spend money to prevent a problem from happening. We want to throw a ton of resources and money at a problem that's already occurred. And so that, you know, what that creates is what you're talking about, right? That creates huge incarceration mm-hmm. problems. That, you know, that creates a lot of the struggles we see today with policing and all of this jazz. When there's a big thing that's sort of been left out in this kind of national conversation, time reform and incarceration and all that stuff, on that, this idea of assessing for it, finding those problems, and then mitigating and managing those problems kind of before they happen goes such a long ways to making those conversations about reforms, incarceration kind of moot, because we've nixed it before it really happens.
Yep. I think that hitting it outright and out front would help a lot of our societal issues, because we wouldn't be perpetuating the violent cycle. And I think that that's something that we should definitely be looking more into. So I want to segue into one more question, and then I think we're going to call it for the evening, if that's all right with you. I don't see anybody else in the audience really raising hands, and we're getting up to almost an hour and a half. Oop, I think somebody joined. Tasca, did you have a question?
I did indeed. Hello. First of all, let me join the other people who thank you for this talk, and thank you very much. It's a very interesting topic, and you're doing a very good job in bringing it across.
Thank you.
I only have a short question, and it is, since you have obviously put great thought into the psychology behind these movements and the reasons why people do the stuff they do, whether you've ever heard of the phenomenon of the standalone complex.
You're talking in the terms of isolation and kind of lone wolf ideology, of somebody being alone and victimized?
It's more about the phenomenon that after an event, people, it's like a copycat, but a copycat of a group, that people who have no connection to each other suddenly start to act towards a common goal.
Yeah.
After an event, inspired by this event.
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really interesting, I mean, then there's a whole like line of work that's kind of done on that. But that's a really interesting phenomenon and behavior that you're talking about, because it really goes back to that idea of like the narrative and the network. And it becomes a sort of like, there's a ghost network that this person went off and did it. They're going through the same thing that I'm going through. They chose to act out this way. This justifies my behavior. I can join them and we will do this together. Yeah, even though there's zero connection whatsoever between them. You know, it's like we see, even to this day, there's still sort of an idolization of the Columbine killers in America from some youth, because they identify them and say, hey, we're like bonded together, we're networked together with them, even though they don't know each other, and that we will have this shared experience.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much, and I'll leave the quorum open to the next questions.
All right, Tasca, I appreciate it. So that's actually going to be where we have to go ahead and call it for the night. I believe our poor recorder, who has so graciously volunteered, Norm, is throwing up the we need to be quiet signal. So, Wolf, I'll ask you just one last time. There were some questions that I was not able to get to. If you feel so inclined, if you wanted to respond to those individually in the discussion and questions room, those will be there. We will not be clearing that room out until we have our next section next week, where hopefully I can get Global Mill Info, who is a wonderful, wonderful OSINT research source on North Korea, as well as a couple other individuals from the community and myself on for a discussion.
Oh, that sounds awesome. I'm looking forward to that talk.
Yep. And also, I want to go ahead real quick, and right as we end, Wolf, if you have a Twitter, go ahead and post it. I'm going to go ahead and plug the OWL Twitter. That's...
I messed up.
Sorry. Yeah, Wolf, go ahead and drop your Twitter link, and I will also be dropping the Twitter link on the discussion questions for the OWL Twitter. We will be using it to call out the next section. Also, thank you, everybody, for coming in for our discussion. This has been the first one, and hopefully out of many. And I will go ahead and say that, once again, Wolf, you fucking crushed it. Like, well, this was amazing.
This was a lot of fun. You know, I love talking about this stuff. This has kind of been my entire life. So, you know, if anybody ever wants to reach out, ask questions about it, I'm trying to tweet more about these things, too, at my Twitter, Odin Threat Intelligence Group. Find me at Inc. Threat. And we will be definitely answering questions and going on there and seeing if I can answer questions and discussions and questions on there too. So feel free to keep throwing them up if you got some later you wanted to ask me. I just really appreciate everybody's time and opportunity to talk about it. Thank you, ACR, for being such a gracious and capable host. You did a great work, sir.
I appreciate it. This is my first time ever hosting something like this. So it's been fun. I learned a lot tonight, and I expect these to continue. I want to go ahead real quick and say to our listeners that if anybody feels like they want to host one of these, please feel free to step forward. I'm taking any and all recommendations right now. We have literally the rest of the year to do this. I want to try to at least have one a week. If I could have multiple a week, man, you guys would be answering prayers and dreams for that. So once again, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me directly or to Wolf, and we will try to get back to answering everybody's questions in the discussion room. I appreciate it. Hopefully a recording will be up soon. We're also going to post it on the Twitter on an announcement with a link to it. And if you missed anything, check it out. All right. Have a good night, everybody.